I'm going to call this meeting of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, April 26, 2022. The time is 8:09 a.m. Currently present are Representative Drummond, Representative McCarty, Representative McCabe, Co-Chair Shragi, and myself, Representative Hannon. Representative Pakatuk has been previously excused. We have a quorum to conduct business. Today, our recording secretary is Lori Rowland. Kelsey Riker is our LIO moderator, and I would like to thank them for being with us at the top of the morning today. Today's agenda, we will hear an introduction of House Bill 303 by request of the governor entitled An Act Relating to Commercial Passenger Vessel Environmental Compliance Relating to Commercial Passenger Vessel Fees, Establishing the Wastewater Infrastructure Grant Fund, Repealing the Authority for Citizen Suits Relating to Commercial Passenger Vessel Environmental Compliance, Repealing the Commercial Passenger Vessel Recognition Program, and Providing for an Effective Date. The committee will also bring up and take action on House Bill 402, an act relating to identification requirements for contractors and home inspectors. With that, we'll get started with our first agenda item. And we'll invite the Department of Environmental Conservation to the table to present House Bill 303 for us. Today we have Randy Bates, the Director of the Division of Water, and Emma Pocon, the Deputy Commissioner. And you'll put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning, Chair Hannon, Chair Shragi. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present to you today on House Bill 303 and DEC's vision for the future of environmental oversight of the cruise industry. Obviously, the pandemic has posed some challenges over the last couple of years for both the industry and for port communities. We wanted to share a little bit today about the what we've done over the last couple of years, the outreach to communities and stakeholders, the work we've done to understand baseline water quality conditions, and also some more specifics for our proposed program going forward.
You know what, I'm going to take a brief at ease. Sorry for the interruption. Go ahead.
Again, Emma Pocon, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Before we get started on the specifics of our proposal, I wanted to share just a little bit of context with the committee. DEC is responsible for protecting water quality throughout the state, and the discharges from all industries are something that we oversee, whether it's resource extraction, community wastewater facilities, or stormwater discharge from construction sites. We're responsible for ensuring that those discharges are in compliance with our rules, with permits, and that water quality standards are protected. We take that job very seriously, and we take it very seriously with the cruise industry. We also understand and respect that we've had cruise industry specific statutes on the books for decades, and that about 15 years ago, we also had a pretty strong statement from Alaskans that in a ballot initiative that they expect that we're going to provide effective oversight of the industry and wastewater discharges in particular. We've taken a hard look at the experience of the last couple of decades, the effectiveness of Ocean Rangers and other DEC mechanisms for oversight. The question that we pose to ourselves and the plan that we've put together and we're here to present to you today really asks the question, how can we most effectively provide oversight of the cruise industry and also protect water quality in the state? How can we most effectively use the funding we have available to ensure water quality is protected and have the best environmental outcomes overall, from both the impacts of cruise ships, but also of passengers and the effects that those passengers have in communities? I'm going to turn it over to Director Bates to share a little bit more about the experience of the last couple of years and the specifics of the bill.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Good morning, top of the morning to you, if I will. My name is Randy Bates. I'm the Director of Water within the Department of Environmental Conservation. Thank you, Chair Hannon, and members of the committee for having us, and most importantly, for hearing this bill, House Bill 303, this morning. I've got a few slides I'll work through and a few remarks. As always, I'm happy to take a break and answer questions if the committee members have such, just to make sure we're all on the same page and you have the information you want. I'll talk through a little bit of 2021 cruise ship oversight, what we did last year, what we're looking forward to in 2022 this year, what the existing challenges have been with the statutes and our program, some of the proposed changes. I'll walk through briefly what those are, what will not change, the fee structure, and then some water quality sampling that we've done and some opportunities in the grant program. So work through a little bit of information and sure appreciate the opportunity to bend your ear a little bit. As Deputy Commissioner Pocon said, it should come to you as no surprise that we take our responsibility to protect human health and the environment very seriously. We expect all industries to operate and comply with the rules of the discharge requirements that we have in place. Specific to our commercial passenger vessel oversight, I want to give you an idea of what our staff looks like. We currently have one marine engineer. We have one full-time environmental protection specialist, and we have two half-time program specialists. So that's initially a total of three full-time positions. We're currently recruiting for an additional marine engineer and one additional full-time environmental program protection specialist. So we'll have a total of five full-time individuals working on cruise ship discharge inspection and enforcement activities. As you're aware, in 2020, there were no vessels in Alaska due to the COVID situation. In 2021, it was a shortened, abbreviated season. We had 13 vessels ply the waters, and that was late in the season. And we had 13 small vessels and 8 large vessels. And the distinguishing characteristic there is that's an important fact as we move through. Large vessels are those vessels with 250 berths or more where people sleep, the bunks that they sleep in. Small vessels are 50 to 249. So that's the distinguishing characteristic. And we manage them differently. So that's a point I wanted to make with you. In 2021, we implemented onboard inspections of commercial passenger vessels operating in Alaska. The large vessels and the Marine Highway System ferries were given a clean bill of health this past season, and they did not incur any discharge violations. It's a great notice, particularly for our Marine ferries. I certainly want to call them out. They're doing a tremendous job of managing their discharges on those ships. So it's important we recognize both the large and the ferries' clean bill of health. The small vessels, those smaller units, 50 to 249 berths, they had challenges with their discharges this past season. Unfortunately, we found ample opportunity to critique their environmental performance of nearly all the smaller vessels operating in the state. Once we did these inspections and worked with their staff on what that sampling looked like, we articulated our expectations for performance. They must meet the environmental practices. We conducted follow-up meetings, required follow-up sampling. We worked with them over the course of the weeks as they troubleshot and continued to sample and test, and generally their water quality discharges improved by the end of the season. And while the lack of vessels in 2020 and the early part of 2021 was unfortunate, this presented an opportunity for us as a department to collect baseline water quality data in ports and common corridor areas that the commercial passenger vessels and everybody else, fishermen and barge lines, transit. And what that did was help us better understand local water quality and the impact of cruise ships, both large and small, on our environment. So it was a wonderful, fortuitous opportunity to go out and collect baseline water quality in 2020, again in 2021. And as we see the industry return in full force, it'll give us that chance to, again, continue to sample and take a look at, is there a difference? Is there an impact that we're seeing?
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair Hannon. So this this might be a good spot to ask a couple questions, if you don't mind. 250 berths or more passenger berths or total berths? So cruise ship.
Yep. Representative McCabe, through the chair, those are passenger berths. So we don't count crew members that are on those vessels. And so they are passenger only berths.
Okay. So thank you for that follow up. And you said that you were given an opportunity to correct some issues with the small boats. Those are small cruise ships specifically we're talking about, right? Because I don't think anybody probably has a 250 berth cabin cruiser, no matter how rich you are. But were there any fines levied, or is it just a kind of a letter of warning and this is what you need to do to correct it, or correct it or else or whatever? How does that work?
Right. Representative McCabe, through the chair, again, thank you for those questions. You're correct. Those small vessels are naming names. We're talking about the UNG Cruises, the National Geographics, the Allen Marines, and a few others. I think there's a total of 19 maybe running the waters this year. They operate under what's called a best management practice, as opposed to what the large vessels do under a general permit. And so those small vessels have to meet a particular standard of 200 fecal units, 200 fecal bacterial units per 100 milliliters of water. That's what the best MSD marine sanitation device can offer. When they don't do that, when they sample as required and they don't do that, we work with them. Right now, I don't know that we have fined anybody yet, and I think that those calculations and negotiations are ongoing. Just because we had an issue with them last year doesn't mean it's wrapped up by now. So there could be something in the works in my compliance and enforcement group that is still, you know, we're still negotiating what the outcome of that would be. But off the top of my head, I'm not aware that we fined anybody particularly for those discharge violations.
Thank you. And one more, if you don't mind. So I'm interested. We established a baseline sort of after the fact from the previous 4 or 5 years. How does the baseline look? I mean, so are we, for instance, the waters around Ketchikan or one of the cruise ship, are the waters more contaminated or less contaminated with the missing ships, if you will, or the missing large vessels?
Thank you, Representative McCabe, through the chair. You're predictive of some of the information I'm going to share.
Okay, I'll wait. I can wait.
Yeah, I'll say the comment just generally, and I'll get into a little bit more detail. Generally, the common corridor areas, as expected, we didn't see any exceedances out there in either the metals, bacteria, or other pollutants that we were searching for. However, in the absence of cruise ships, both in 2020 and 2021, we saw plenty of water quality exceedance in communities when there's no contributing cruise ship areas. These are local contributions, either from boat harbors with resident liveaboards or other discharge systems that are not meeting water quality standards. So we'll touch a little bit on that in a bit, but that's the general outcome.
I've got a couple questions on the 2021 season, and I just want to clarify. It was 13 small vessels and 8 large vessels?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And could you tell me of those, so 13 vessels, how many of the small vessels, how many different corporate lines, I guess, for businesses? So, you know, were 12 of them run cruises and what, and I don't need to know their names, but that's what I'm getting at, and I'll have the same on the large vessels.
Okay, Madam Chair, thank you for the question. I will confirm, if I don't get this right in my words, I'll confirm and follow up. My understanding, if I remember correctly, last year we had 13 vessels operating under 4 parent lines for the small vessels. I believe we had 2 or 3 companies of large vessels that were operating in the state.
And did you see, were there significant, so of the 13 vessels, and you've expressed it in small vessels, we had a number of discharge violations. Were they concentrated in any one vessel or any one operator? Or were they equally distributed violations?
Madam Chair, they were equally distributed. And I had direct conversations with the owners of each of these companies and vessels. We had teleconferences as soon as we got the reports back. We asked them to continue to follow up. All the companies recognized that their discharges were a challenge, and they all committed immediately to making changes to diagnose why. What is happening? What is wrong with our systems? Why aren't they producing at the level, the compliant level that we expect them to produce at? And I mean, there's reasons. There's always reasons. None of them are good enough for me. If you're going to operate in the state, you're going to operate in compliance with the laws that we have out there. And if you're going to show up in the state and you don't have discharge that meets our water quality requirements, I'm going to have a meeting with you. That's how it is. So there was improvement over the course of the season. Some of them didn't make the progress we wanted to. Some of them were immediate right away. I think at least two of the main companies, two of the four small vessels, brought the owners of the treatment systems, the manufacturers of the treatment systems on board, help diagnose why aren't they getting there.
And prior to the 21 season, what was our inspection of small vessels? I know what we were doing prior to 20, back in 19, with large vessels. What were we doing for monitoring of those small vessels prior to the COVID opportunity to look at it differently?
Madam Chair, again, thank you for the question. And this gets into some of the exciting stuff of what we're doing and why we're doing it. In the past, we have not taken a particular hard look at the small vessels. The Ocean Rangers, which is going to be a topic of conversation, were never on board those small vessels. Our staff looked at the permits, the best management practices, and worked with the owners on the sampling, worked with the owners and operators on the sampling and moving them towards compliance. We have not, to the best of my knowledge, done inspections on those small vessels before, nor taken as active an approach in bringing them to compliance as we have in the last couple of years, last year and this year. Unfortunately, I will tell you the most recent news that I have is we did an inspection 2 weeks ago of the one vessel that has already run a tour. We were less than thrilled with their performance of their discharge. Their first group on board, they are supposed to be discharging at a level of 200 fecal units per 100 milliliters. That particular small vessel was producing at 2.6 million, which exceeds any water quality metric, let alone some of our most challenged community publicly owned treatment systems. Those are the small vessels that typically haven't had coverage or oversight in the past, particularly by Ocean Rangers.
Well, and, you know, of concern, and you know this and I know this, but put on the record, you know, one of the concerns is those small vessels by design, by advertisement, but they're going into much more remote and I would say less impacted. So they're going into small bays and nooks, not adjacent to communities where there's any other community discharge, but they're the only operator there at a pristine bay. So that gives me deep concern. I also have one follow-up, which is I'm looking for the staffing. So you've described some staffing that you've had, and I want to know how much of their time it took on these 24 ships that we were monitoring last year. Because in that, you know, 21 season with one marine operator and you had a staff of three doing those 24. But if we anticipate going to the levels of what the 2019 field season looked like, I would have an expectation that the staffing would need to be substantially higher to still do that level of monitoring as we rebound to what it was in 2019. So how much of your staff, of those three people you've described, or three positions, was taken up with the monitoring last year? Was that 25% of their time or 100% of their time?
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm going to separate out two different terms, if I could. Monitoring is something, in my mind, that's the water quality monitoring and sampling that we did. And I have staff that do that. They're in a water quality section. And that takes, we've got a couple people tasked on that one. When we're talking about the inspections, the marine engineer, the EPS-3, and the two part-times, those are dedicated cruise ship individuals. And so over the course of the year, there's two of them that are dedicated 100% of the time, the marine engineer and the EPS-3. And they work through the year, excuse me, on cruise ship issues. registration or review of the general permit or review of the best management practices, training on sampling, training on whatever it is, they are fully consumed for the entire year for those two individuals. The other two that I said were part-time, they are inspection specific, and so we half-time them on inspections under a permitting program, our APDES permit program, and the other half is spent on cruise ship, summertime cruise ship inspections. When we bring these other two individuals on, they're going to be full-time year-round as well, working on all of these issues. So does that answer your question, Rep?
It does, but it does not seem to be an adequate level going forward, you know.
Madam Chair, if I could, I will say the dedication that we have in this, I don't mean to interrupt your.
No, go ahead.
The dedication we have in this group of individuals greatly exceeds any other industry oversight that we have. The amount of effort that we put into the oversight of the cruise ship program in particular, 100% inspections early in the season, follow-up with scheduled and unscheduled inspections, ride-alongs in between ports, that is a greater level of oversight than any other industry experiences in the state, whether it's oil and gas, mining, publicly owned treatment facilities. So
I understand that, but very few industries in our state migrate and move like that with the potential of substantial damage into a remote location. You know, every other industry that you've described basically has some transportation issue associated, but its primary concern over our discharge is located at,
sure,
you know, where the fish plant is, where the mine is. So that is always, that's one of the reasons that the oversight has been, because it's, you know, and the ugly history has been when there was oversight, when you were inside a town, there wasn't a problem. It was when you were out of view and in a remote location, that's when those illegal discharges that drew the ire of Alaskans to lead us to a ballot initiative. So as much as it gets compared to other industries, cruise ships are a very unique industry of the migration of that situation in an industrial complex as well as a community complex. But I do have other members. So Representative Drummond and then Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this presentation. Mr. Bates, when you mentioned the how the vessels are sized, 250 passengers and up for the larger ones and 50 to 249 for the small ones, that ship that was here last night, that has a capacity of over 4,000 passengers and 1,700 crew, almost 50% of the passengers. How can you not consider the number of crew? And those smaller ships tend to have a higher crew to passenger ratio because they pride themselves on service. But that's a lot of human beings, and all of them produce fecal matter. For the lack of a less obvious term, I'm just curious how you account for the additional human beings on these vessels.
Representative Drummond, through the chair, again, thank you. Great observation, great question. We're in the business of those jokes too, by the way.
I'm sure.
Just a big kid in a man's body, I guess. But we actually follow the federal definition under a variety of different sources. Most recently, the Vessel Incidental Discharge Act defines vessels based on passenger berths, not including crew. And that's how that rule came down. We follow, I don't know how we promulgated it necessarily back in 2001 or previous. That's how we characterize commercial passenger vessels. Mm-hmm. The discharge requirements is irregardless of the number of passengers that are on board. So whether they have 251 or 5,021, they still have to produce and have a treatment system on board that at the point of discharge, it is meeting the water quality standards. So however much they eat, however much they discharge as individuals, it still gets treated in the same way so that when it comes out of the pipe on the boat, it is at that water quality level for fecal in particular.
And just a follow-up and observation. I think around 2011, I had a tour of a Princess cruise ship in Whittier.
Mm-hmm.
And top to bottom, or rather bottom to top, we saw everything in how right. how they recycle all their trash, how they sort it all, how they their water processing system. And I remember the fellow who was leading the tour showed us the clear water at the end of this processing structure. And I'm just curious. I'm sure we're going to learn more about it as we proceed through this presentation, because I know that in port they don't discharge, but you know they've got these systems, these big ships especially.
Right.
And when they leave, and when they leave port, and they're out of reach, and they're in the I forget what the zone is called. How can they be allowed to not utilize the equipment that they have paid for and have on their ship? And I understand the size difference for the small ones, and I can understand why they may not have the same kind of water treatment. But that kind of numbers that you just stated a few minutes ago, that's unacceptable.
Correct.
Simply unacceptable.
Correct.
If I might add to the director's response on the prior question as well, the Alaska statutes also differentiate specifically and define large and small based on the number of passengers and consistent with what's in the federal rules. So we're following what's in statute there too in that definition. But as the director said, those discharges are based, and what the standards are for the discharges are based on what the discharge is at the end of the pipe, not necessarily the number of people on the boat.
Thank you.
Representative McCarthy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm looking at this and also looking at the bill. Page 4 talks about installing and operates an electronic monitoring system. Think of ADS-B in aviation. They know where you're at. They know what level you're at as you're flying the sky. There's no discharging from my plane as I'm flying, but the point is, and I go to the Marine Exchange, and it's phenomenal to see this enormous screen, and it sees, right. it looks at all the marine highway activities going on, and if a large ship or small ship, whatever that's on this, is too close to shore, that they could become go aground, that they could alert them right away, because this monitoring system is in effect, which gets to the question of Chair Hanna, that you know, do we need more workers, or are we looking at a system that's like this, that you have few workers that can be monitoring, and systems that's going to let them know, and if there's a discharge that doesn't fit the formula, its monitoring system is on it, and it's letting us know where it's being discharged and the rate that's being discharged. Am I interpreting this correctly?
Representative McCarthy, through the chair. Again, great observation. We're well aware, and I took a tour of the Alaska Marine Exchange recently this year. I happen to be a commercial fisherman, and so I'm familiar with AIS and what it can do and how to operate it and how you get to pay attention to other boats that are coming your direction. The idea, we actually, within the bill, we have a provision in there that, as you point out, provides an incentive for a CPV, either small or large, to provide us with electronic monitoring of their wastewater discharges. If they do that in a manner that we feel we can work with, they get a dollar off of their $5 per berth fee. It's a reasonable incentive, we believe, to build an electronic tracking system for their discharges. There's no doubt in my mind we still need people to get on the vessels and inspect them, to run the pipes, to compare the engineering plans that we have in the office with what we're seeing in person. We need to have those relations between our staff, our marine engineers, and our protection specialists, and the vessel engineers, officers, and others. So there's that dialogue that's necessary. I don't want to get away from that. I would love to see additional electronic monitoring coming out of the vessels to be able to track them and know where their flows are in terms of discharge of wastewater, what that flow rate is, and be able to track it, particularly if we see issues.
So through the chair, does the technology exist that it would know the flow rate that's coming out? I know technology exists and knows where you're at, but if that's installed on there, would it know the flow rate?
Representative McCarthy, through the chair, I don't know the answer to that. That might be a question better posed to the industry. If we're talking specifically flow rate, I don't know exactly how that would be calculated electronically. I'd love to think I could come up with it if we had the time and funds. But that's a question best posed, I suppose, to the industry. You're right. They could just give us a lat long and GPS coordinates and say, I open my pipes here. I close my pipes there. We got it. We can now GPS track that on a map. What matters is, was it just a little crack of the pipe or was it full flow? You know, how much came out? Did they dump 5 gallons, 100 gallons, or 500,000 gallons? I don't know the answer to that. They should be able to help answer that if they were asked that question.
Well, I look forward to you responding back with whatever technology exists. That would be nice to know. Thanks.
Geek.
All right. Seeing no questions, we'll let you proceed.
Whew.
Yeah.
Moving right along. We're answering a lot of questions early. Thank you. I did talk a little bit about that background water quality sampling that we did in 2020 and 2021. As part of that effort, we did sample 19 ports, and we sampled numerous common corridor transit lanes for the bacteria, metals, and ammonia. And as I mentioned, despite the absence of cruise ships in those 2 years, limited cruises in 2021, we saw high bacteria concentrations at several ports. We look forward to continue monitoring for water quality into 2022 and beyond. And we're going to continue to collect that data to help tell a story about water quality in our southeast area, south central area, western Alaska, in and around our port communities and in those common corridor areas. We've got a pretty robust sampling schedule, and I look forward to continuing that.
Representative McCarty.
Thank you, through the chair. So your sampling schedule or samplings, how far back do they go? Because you set a baseline, but you've been doing sampling for 5 years, 20 years, 50 years prior to that?
Representative McCarty, through the chair. We've been performing water quality sampling in port areas proximal to the vessel since 2015. More recently, with a 2020 increment in our base budget, we were able to dedicate additional funding specific to evaluating water quality in more areas. And so we've been able to continue and make a little bit more robust sampling schedule and program. And so that's included. It's including many common corridor areas, Lynn Canal, Chatham Straits, Port Frederick, Outer Coast, a number of the areas where all the vessels ply the waters, in addition to more sampling in and around the ports where the cruise ships go.
Go ahead and continue.
Chair. I think I touched on this. Registrations for 2022 include 41 large vessels, 18 small vessels, and that's going to be about 1.65 million passengers coming to Alaska on these two cruise ship categories, largest and smalls. Our staff will continue to perform those initial and annual inspections. We expect to be on board all of the vessels, large and small, within the first 3 to 4 weeks of their arrival in Alaska. They are required to sample water, their discharge water, report those to us. We will follow up, make sure that the sampling protocols are correct, the logs are filled out, the pipes run where they're supposed to, the treatment tanks and discharges are appropriate. We have a full inspection complement planned. We will continue to do, after that initial inspection of each of the vessels, we will continue to do scheduled and unscheduled visits with vessels that we either want to or need to follow up with. We're also going to perform inspections as from port to port or per voyage, so there'll be ride-alongs. Typically, vessels discharge after they leave port while they're underway, and so if you here in Juneau, you know, that may be that they're leaving Juneau, and once they get out to a bigger water body, they'll begin their discharges on their way to Sitka or something like that. And what we want to do is make sure that rather than just our inspectors being in port, we want to do a ride-along. And my staff will work at night as they do their discharges, as the vessels do their discharges underway. and we'll monitor and watch that as it happens.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Co-Chair Hannon. So just one quick question. Your initial inspection, I think the Coast Guard, the government does an initial one too. So are you part of the team that goes on board in the first few weeks of the sailings, and the Coast Guard does a safety inspection and they do some stuff with the crew, and your guys do the same thing? So it all kind of happens at once?
Representative McCabe, through the chair. Thank you. The answer is yes and no. We work with the Coast Guard to make sure that we understand what their inspections look like, what focus they're taking, and we understand the timing. They do a lot of their inspections down in Seattle or Bremerton or somewhere else. We've talked about incorporating some of our issues into theirs and theirs into ours, and we're coordinated on that. We've actually got an MOU with them. So we don't all go on board at the same time, but we definitely go on board. We overlap some areas of coverage. Their issue is safety, compliance, oil, other things under the federal law. Ours is very specifically air, water discharges. So we have a little bit different focus, but we're certainly given a full comprehensive look at these vessels and how they operate.
Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you. Mr. Bates, did I hear you say that you're expecting 1.6 million passengers in 2022?
Representative Drummond, through the chair, that's correct.
And once again, is that just passengers, or are we ignoring the up to 50% additional crew that also get off the ships, spend money? If any of you have ever seen the vans that leave, or the buses that leave these big ships and go to Fred Meyer and Costco with just crew aboard, I mean, these people are here, they're spending money. Somehow, I can't imagine that they would not also be considered, because that's going to bring it up into the 2 million plus range if you count the if you count the crew and don't ignore them, right? Because that's a pretty major number of people.
Representative Drummond, through the chair, that is correct. When we look at the cost per berth, or what we're collecting in these CPV fees, we do not add in crew share, crew costs. Mm-hmm. Those are incidental. Those are part of the vessel as they come up. We do, and it's another one of these little tidbits and a really exciting point of this bill. We are proposing a grant program in the bill to assist port communities in infrastructure improvements that are related specifically to vessels and vessel traffic. And so a community like Skagway, with a population of a couple thousand, to see 1.6 million passengers come through and crew is a major contribution to their wastewater flow. And this grant program would be intended to facilitate their upgrades and infrastructure improvements to be able to help them better handle that wastewater treatment that is a result of both crew and passengers that come off those vessels, not just their community residents. So,
thank you.
Let me just clarify, if you can, for us, that number you gave, 1.65, that's based on the vessel size on the schedule they've published. But for instance, when that vessel arrived yesterday, we did not actually, well, they would have known when they left Seattle, whether they were operating with full capacity of their berths, because the industry doesn't, they're not required to share that with us until they're coming to port. That's correct, isn't it? So that 1.65 is based on scheduling of the number of berths available. That doesn't mean that all those berths will be full.
Madam Chair, that's correct. My understanding is they put butts in bunks is the way they term it. They want to fill every bunk that they can.
And then one more follow-up. The CPVV, the passenger vessel charge that we have, that's only if the berth is full, that they do not pay that for a berth that sailed empty. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's not correct. Currently they pay. So structurally, vessels are required to tell us by March 1st whether they're going to ply the waters of Alaska, and tell us how many passengers they're going to have on each of those voyages. And a voyage is defined as a port to port. So Juneau to Skagway, Skagway to Haines, Haines to Sitka. That's one voyage per. And so they tell us, are they coming to Alaska? How many passengers are they bringing? And that's going to be a max capacity number. In the past, we have not allowed a rebate or a true up at the end of the year. And so what they tell us they're going to bring in March is what we charge them, and that's what we collect for both the Ocean Ranger fee and the CPB fee as it currently exists. What we recognized through conversations with a number of the owner and operators is that they would, particularly as related to COVID, when they're at half capacity or quarter capacity, they wanted the ability to true up at the end of the year. So if they said they were going to have 100 passengers and they only had 50 or 80, they wanted that opportunity to get a rebate or a refund if they didn't fill those berths. We said, fine, that's okay. We can handle that. So that we actually built that refund mechanism in this bill here for your consideration.
Wouldn't it be true that they could also, especially, let's say, in COVID, a small vessel where they were going to operate at 50% capacity and they have 100 berths, but they could have said, we're going to operate at 50% capacity, so although we have 100 berths, we're only going to fill 50 of them, and we're only going to pay the state for 50. They just couldn't have exceeded that. So they didn't and should not have said, we're going to run all 100 berths if their operational plan was to operate at 50% capacity or 80% capacity. So, you know, the industry has some accuracy of predictive reporting that's within their control. They don't. You may tell you may tell your shareholders that you're selling every berth every day, but certainly they know that their shoulder season berths are unlikely to be as full as their prime season berths. Representative McCarty.
That's an interesting to the chair, Hannah. That's an interesting reflection. Certainly, this past 2 years, industry all over Alaska has been greatly, and so there's not a ability to get out that crystal ball and know what's going to be the future. I like what we're saying, that we're going to recognize that we don't have the crystal ball either, and we're going to work with industry to not stick it to them when they are greatly affected by that. I have a question for you to clarify this, that something that Representative Drummond brought up. In my mind, the cruise ships, when they design them, they have the, I use this term here, gigantic septic tanks in the cruise ship designed for the size, amount of berths that exist, both crew and passengers, customers. So if they fill the ship completely, that septic tank in the cruise ship is able to contain all that, and then the release is appropriately at the rate that we say it's got to be. So if it doesn't break down, it's not released until it gets to that point in expectation. Is that correct thinking?
Representative McCarty, through the chair, that is correct thinking. So, and I mentioned this earlier, irrespective of the number of passengers or crew, the discharge limits are still in place. They have to meet those regardless of the volume of either passengers or discharge.
So follow up. So cruise ship that comes in here and is in the waters and then goes out to an area where it could discharge, it may discharge. It's not just going to just open up the gates and flood the whole area. It's discharging as appropriate too, and maybe gets out into open waters completely, and it may discharge more in those waters of such. Is that accurate to think?
Representative McCarty, through the chair, that is accurate. My understanding is some vessels choose not to discharge either in port or underway in the Alexander Archipelago. Rather, they wait until they're more than 12 miles off our coast to then discharge for whatever reason. But that's what we've heard from a number of the vessels, large vessels.
Last follow. So if we have these monitoring systems there, that's the GPSing, knowing what the flow and stuff like that, it really gives us more data collection to see how it may affect. And is that accurate to say?
Representative McCarty through the chair, yes. And I know I go beyond just the yes or no, but there's we do get data right now on a log sheet that says we discharged at this latitude and longitude at this time. So we get that in writing. It then requires us to transpose that into, which we haven't done, into a GPS-based system, which I'm pushing to have that done so that we can take all of our past data, input it into a system, overlay it, and see where the discharges are occurring. An electronic system would give us immediate information along those lines, today, tomorrow, whatever it may be. We can't see the future, but we can see what happened today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Were you speaking?
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. So this large vessels, small vessels, the discharge, I think I heard you just say, it doesn't matter if it's got 1,600 passengers and 4,000 crew or 4,000 passengers and 1,600 crew, the discharge limits are the same, right? It's just the money we're getting, which is the dividing line between small and large, and a way to sort of differentiate the vessels. And I'm sure you took a percentage of crew into account when they made that differentiation. You said it came from the federal government, that differentiation between small and large and crew members and all that.
Representative McCabe through the chair. That's correct.
So, okay, and you're going to get into the rest of my questions here a little bit later, I see, so I'll just hold them. Thank you.
Okay, before we leave this slide, you talked about, Mr. Bates, onboard inspections when the vessels are underway. And I want to understand how similar that is to the Ocean Ranger program, because in your description it sounds identical to what Ocean Rangers were designed to do and did do, but I'm not sure if that's accurate.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. What we're working towards, and last year having such a limited season and having such few vessels ply the waters, it gave us a wonderful opportunity with our existing staff to set up these protocols for inspection and ride-alongs. We did do a ride-along last year with one vessel between here and Ketchikan. And the expectation is they will get on, let's just say it's between Juneau as a port and Ketchikan as the destination. Our staff would get on in Juneau, ride that vessel down for however long it takes. Let's just say it's a 24-hour ride. The vessel is going to discharge at some point during the night while they're underway above 6 knots. It's typically how vessels operate, large vessels operate. So our crew, my staff, would be on board starting at 8 p.m. at night. They'd work through the night. They would get we've negotiated with the vessels to have a crew berth. So it's just a private berth, but it's a bunk. It's not a cabin. It's not a passenger cabin in the way that the Ocean Rangers were put up, but it's a crew quarter type of cabin. They would operate for a full eight hour day or longer as necessary to get the inspection done underway, with particular focus on witnessing and watching the discharge. They're not going to see the discharge necessarily that comes out of the pipe, because that discharge pipe is under the vessel, 3 meters below the surface. It's at night. You're not either going to see the discharge, or you may not see the wash as it comes through the props, particularly because it is exceptionally clear, clean water compared to some of the other discharges that we see coming out of our own community pipes. So it would be ride-alongs with badge authority, inspection, access to all the doors that we want to get behind as necessary. And that's what we envision. That's what we did last year. That's what we imagine going forward. It's certainly different than the Ocean Ranger program. In addition, our inspectors have that badge authority. So if we saw something that was significantly challenging or in a pollutant type nature to the environment, we could stop something immediately. We could handle that as appropriate with our existing authority. Ocean Rangers were observers. They didn't necessarily have that capacity. They couldn't get behind all the doors. So there's a major difference. between what I expect my staff to be able to do versus what the authority of the Ocean Rangers was. They both provided a very important service, but I think right now, the way we're moving, we have a valuable program that is very cost-effective with our own staff doing this.
Okay. We'll proceed.
Okay.
I don't see anybody else getting my attention. So go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to highlight another point that I have in here, small vessels for the first time are getting the same love as the large vessels. It's really important to recognize that. And it appears to be necessary. We're moving through. So I'll move through some of this existing challenges. This is important. We've had the ability to regulate and oversee commercial passenger environmental compliance since the department was created in 1971. We've had specific commercial passenger vessel statutes passed in 2001. Additional amendments were made in 2003 addressing small vessels. Additional statutory and regulatory changes have been made with a ballot measure, ballot measure 2, put in place in 2006, addressing vessel operations. The progressive development of our CPV laws, Madam Chair, is it okay if I use CPV as an acronym?
Many members all understand that?
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Rolls off the tongue maybe easier, yeah, if you will. The progressive development of our CPV specific laws, the passage of that ballot measure 2, and the implementation of our Ocean Ranger program was a clear message that Alaskans wanted DEC to improve our oversight of CPVs and their environmental compliance. We've improved that oversight. We continue to evaluate our compliance of CPVs. And for many years, we've gained a significant amount of experience, knowledge in what works, what is effective, are there gaps in coverage, and what could be improved in our oversight and management of the vessels. Collectively, the existing statutes as they're currently housed provide some challenges to us. They require outdated, inefficient reporting methods. They're difficult to change or adjust when waste treatment and monitoring technologies improve. They've included the expensive Ocean Ranger program that we've talked about, and we had DEC's the existing program on the books that were in statute right now. They have DEC staff in the office spending significant time reviewing the written Ocean Ranger reports. For several years, we've seen that CPV fleet increase, the loads have increased in Alaska, and we know that the majority of these vessels and crew disembark in port, visit our shop, as Representative Drummond has said. They visit our shops and our shoreside attractions, and thankfully they create an economy in our communities. But they also leave that waste that our communities must collect and treat. And we know that our port communities are impacted by these CPV passengers that use the onshore facilities. And all of these port communities could likely use some assistance to upgrade those treatment facilities and improve their wastewater discharge and water quality effluent. Talk quickly, if I will, about the proposed changes, what we're looking to do.
Yes. Representative McCabe.
Sorry to go back to the other slide, if you wouldn't mind, Madam Co-Chair. So, third bullet of the 2006 ballot initiative, Ocean Ranger observations produced 6 notices of violations over 12 years. How many sailings, how many reports did it take to get to 6 violations? I mean, if there were 6 reports and 6 violations, that would be 100% good thing. If there were 6 violations over 12 years and thousands of reports, maybe not so effective. And if you don't know that, we can get that later. I'm just kind of curious how effective, and I think that's what you're driving at anyways, is how effective the Ocean Ranger, or ineffective it's been for the water quality samplings.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, and it looks like Deputy Commissioner's going to chime in too. It's the latter. It is 6 violations through thousands of voyages. And that's the 6 violations that we as a department pursued. The Ocean Rangers submit a report, and they say these are the observations. We take a look at those. Some of them we resolve immediately with the vessels. six of which progressed to a notice of violation. And that's been through the course of 12 years, originally with 100% coverage of Ocean Rangers. 2019, they were on 60% of the voyages. So it's been a decline of participation in the ocean or coverage by the Ocean Ranger program. But I would say it's not as effective necessarily as a we're not interested in violations of the vessels. We want compliance at best. But it's also a recognition that the Clean Water Act and everything that we have out there in terms of our inspection and authority, we want vessels to self-monitor, all industries, self-monitor, self-report. And so we have significantly more violations associated with vessels self-reporting than we do with Ocean Ranger observations that result in notices of violation.
Thanks. I appreciate that. I think you got to the spot that the deputy commissioner was going to talk about.
You need to give her some more thunder here.
Good job. You guys are working well together.
Yeah. But I do feel like I got to say that was our expectation when the ballot measure was passed. If you have the policeman standing by the stop sign, fewer people should run the stop sign with the police officer standing there. And, you know, Ocean Rangers have had zero cost to the state. All captains and all ship marine engineers on board a large vessel knew that an Ocean Ranger was on board. They had to make a reservation. They had to pay full freight in a passenger room, no discounting. They had to seek permission to enter the engineer room at any point for any observation. So, you know, in the classic teenager, if mom says I'm coming into the room and knocks, you know enough to kick the junk under the bed if she's coming to inspect to see if the room is clean. You know, you at least did that before they opened the door. And sort of the expectation was with an observer on board, there should be zero violations. Those should just be the accidental violations because, you know, they're going to come down and look at your logs and your ledgers. But even then, human error happens. Go ahead.
Thanks, Co-Chair Hannon. So I heard that as well. I read that there is zero cost to the state inside a bunch of rhetoric on budget. And then I have also seen where there is some cost to the state, I think coming from ledge finance. So it might be something that we should work out is how much the Ocean Rangers cost the state versus the benefit, because I don't think that necessarily the entire truth is out there. Truth is a wrong word, but the entire picture is out there for how much they cost the state versus the benefit that they get because of the exact thing that you just said. You know, everybody knows when they're there, and everybody, so it's no different than the observers on the trawlers, right? Everybody knows they're there, and the boat captains do a special fishery just for the observers. So there's a better way to do it, I think, maybe less costly. And I agree, if we can get them to self-report and fix their own stuff and bring them into compliance with inspections, maybe that's a better way of doing business. Cheaper, certainly.
None of us are opposed to better compliance with cleaner water in Alaska. That's what everyone who supported Ocean Rangers was after, because they were in you know, the advocates who organized the Ocean Rangers were from communities where there was illegal dumping arriving on their doorstep, on their shoreline. And after years of very little federal oversight and enforcement and sort of naysaying, when our most pristine waters were actively being polluted with dry cleaning discharge in Glacier Bay, Alaskans said, that's enough. We're not just talking about you accidentally, you know, the septic system didn't work today. We were talking about piping systems that were illegally bypassing all treatment oversight. And that's what led us to that. Now, in the aftermath of that, we would expect that all good operators were going to comply, right? That's what we expect in a civil society of when we set the standard and the law that most citizens are going to comply, and most of our commercial operators want to be good citizens. But on the other hand, we want to make sure that Alaskan waters are as protected and clean as we can be, and no one is opposed to better monitoring and more compliance from industry.
I agree. Yeah. I think we're going to get to the hypocrisy of some of this in slide 10.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'm sure we'll get to slide 10 today, too.
if we quit talking.
No. I appreciate the questions and the dialogue for sure. You're just predicting some of my talking points already, all of you, so I appreciate that. Madam Chair, if I could, just a minor correction. The discharge in Glacier Bay was a self-reported discharge of pool water, is my understanding, pool water that had not been dechlorinated. There's no doubt that that's a significant discharge in an area that has absolutely zero allowance for discharge. The difference between dry cleaning chemicals and pool water is...
So is the dry cleaning discharge that was... there was a dry cleaning discharge that led to the Ocean Ranger ballot measure.
Okay.
So it was just a different location.
Sure.
It was not Glacier Bay. Right?
I think the most recent Glacier Bay violation was a pool water discharge.
Yeah.
So.
And I don't think anybody has dry cleaners on board anymore.
What?
Or photochemicals. There's another one.
Right, photochemicals. Yeah. Nobody has darkroom processors on board anymore.
What are those? Madam Chair, thank you. Proposed changes, and I know I really appreciate the time you're taking with this, and I'll move as quickly as I can, but I want to make sure you guys have the information you want. We're moving detailed statutes to regulations, giving us greater flexibility, strengthening and clarifying authority for staff to be able to board and inspect CPVs. I think we've talked a little bit about that. Ocean Rangers could not get behind doors. We have absolute authority to get in where we need to get in to ensure compliance with our environmental laws. As Representative McCarty raised, we're incorporating technology, encouraging development of electronic real-time monitoring technology for discharge monitoring. We want to see timely and formatted reporting that will allow our staff to spot areas of concern quicker for easier response. We're replacing multiple fees assessed on commercial passenger vessels with a single fee of $5 per berth per voyage. We're repealing the Ocean Ranger program, and importantly, we're establishing a grant program to help finance wastewater infrastructure improvements for port communities serving CPV passengers. This bill has a zero fiscal note. There is a slight revenue increase associated with the application of the berth fees, particularly to the small commercial passenger vessels. Recognizing that change and potential impact of the small vessels, we built in the transition provisions a delayed effective date for those changing berth fees specific to the small CPVs. And so that transition provision will go into effect in 2024 to give them time to accommodate that increase. What will not change with the statutes that are out there? DEC's authority for inspections, our registration system, which we touched on, the air emission monitoring program, the large commercial passenger vessel general permit, the small CPV requirements, our sampling and reporting requirements, discharges and the water quality standards, and that recognition program that's already in statute. This slide is a picture of what our current matrix looks like in statute. It is a combination of CPVEC, commercial passenger environmental compliance, fees, along with Ocean Ranger fees. CPVEC fees applied to both large and small vessels, and that was a matrix that ranged from 70 cents per lower berth to $1.75 per lower berth. And so that applied to all large and small vessels. The Ocean Ranger fee in and of itself, $4 per berth fee, was applicable only to all those large vessels. And then in that case, it was to the lower berths, not all berths at that point. What we did is we simplified that fee structure. So all vessels, small and large, will be paying a straight $5 per berth fee, per lower berth. The large vessels will pay roughly the same, about a $17,000 increase over an annual about $6.8 million fee for the large vessels. The small vessels will pay more under this scenario, and that's about an $80,000 increase over their current annual fee of $18,000. And that's $18,000 for the entire small vessel fleet for the annual summer season. As we mentioned earlier, there's a $1 reduction for electronic monitoring systems that are put in place. And also, as mentioned, we're building in the statutes the opportunity for a rebate as a true-up for the end-of-the-year numbers based on actual lower berth occupancy. We don't expect that to be a significant change in seasonal numbers. Like I said, the vessels want to put everybody in berths as they can, so they're not in the business of not filling their berth spaces. And this picture and this conversation is really, to me, some of what really gets exciting and is an opportunity in this bill. As mentioned previously, in the absence of CPVs in 2020 and then half a season in 2021, there were high bacterial concentrations associated with human waste that we were able to diagnose at several ports. We recognize that with CPV traffic, local port community wastewater treatment facility exceedances often coincided with the seasonal influx of CPV passengers. So if you take the existing water quality challenges that some of our communities already have in the absence of CPVs, and you put a 1.6 million passenger group in addition to crew members, that stresses some of their already stressed systems. So it appears that the passenger traffic in these port communities has a strong correlation with increased treatment needs and requirements of these small port communities. And what this graph shows, and I think we've laughed about this before, if you actually count up those dots, and I'm not suggesting we take the time, there are 40 fecal colony forming units in that one column on the left-hand side. That is the large cruise ship permit allowance for discharge. They are only allowed to discharge treated water with a maximum of 40 colony units per 100 milliliters of water. Many of our local wastewater treatment facilities, like Sitka, Skagway, and to some degree Charcoal Point and Ketchikan, they allow the discharge of up to 1.5 million fecal colony units per 100 milliliters of water. A significant difference in treatment capacity on board the vessels, as well as discharge allowance at each of those facilities, either large vessels, small vessels, or our publicly owned treatment facilities.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I'm seeing the word allows here. This isn't what's actually happening necessarily. It's just what is being allowed. So you're saying that the Sitka Wastewater Treatment Facility allows up to, or whatever, Skagway, whichever one, allows up to 1.5 million fecal colony forming units per 100 milliliters. What's actually happening when the cruise ships show up with all the passengers? Are we exceeding the allowance? Are we under the allowance? And I'd also like to, I think that would sort of determine on whether or not maybe we need to change the allowance. I don't know. I know that we can't really call the fecal forming units pollution because they're natural substance and we allow them into our groundwater all over the place with septic systems and outhouses and that sort of thing. And we allow the cruise ships to discharge when they get way offshore. It's a natural substance. It's eaten by the fish or it breaks down somehow or it provides nitrogen for the kelp and all that sort of thing. I guess I was editorializing a bit, but what actually happens in those cities? Are we going over the allowance when the passenger ships show up?
Representative McCabe, through the chair. The answer is, let me frame it this way. We have water quality standards that are uniform and to be applied consistently across the industry for all dischargers, whether it's a mine, whether it's an oil and gas, whether it's a solid waste facility. They all have to meet the same water quality standards. In this case, our fecal limit is 40 units at the end of pipe. And so these vessels are meeting that. These large vessels are meeting that. Our small vessels under the BMPs, they don't have the advanced wastewater treatment systems that the large vessels have. They have what's called a marine sanitation device. And if operated in accordance with the Coast Guard rules and how they're meant to be implemented, the best treatment they can achieve is somewhere just a little north of 200 units, 200 fecal units. The difference, our local treatment, Juneau Douglas and the Mendenhall treatment here in Juneau, they're allowed to discharge. There's actually a gradated type of system, 2, 4, 800, but the maximum is 800 fecal units for those facilities. They bump up against that. There are occasional exceedances on a daily or monthly basis, and we've worked with them on what those exceedances are. But they're really working hard to achieve those and stay within water quality standards, and by and large, they're doing a good job. When you talk about, I think the numbers, Ward Cove, daily max, 800. Charcoal Point, Ketchikan, 1.25 million. Sitkin Skagway, daily max, 1.5 million. This next slide shows some of those numbers. Those are big differences, and what we're seeing is some of those areas are bumping up, if not going over those numbers, our local communities. Skagway's a great example. I don't have numbers of compliance or water quality levels for you, but absolutely, the influx of individuals off the CPV, the passengers and crew, they're stressing their system. It's a system built for a population of 2,000 that now accommodates 1.6 million on a 5-month window of time. It's a big ask for a small community to maintain for 7 months a system that's necessary to treat that type of wastewater from a transient population. So,
Representative McCabe, through the chair, if I may, I'll add to that, you know, obviously a significant factor is what treatment technology is available on the large vessels versus the small vessels versus in the communities. So, yes, the permits set what the allowable limit is, but in terms of what is actually discharged, that is varying significantly just based on what the treatment technology is that's available.
Follow-up? Thank you. So I'm still confused. It says up in the previous slide, it says local wastewater treatment facility permit allows up to 1.5 fecal colony forming units per 100 milliliters. And looking down here, I see Skagway maximum 1.5, average monthly is 1 million, Sitka the same. So it sounds like, yes, they're bumping up against it. I'm not sure where, you know, like Ward Cove, you say daily maximum is 800. Is that what we allow them, or do we actually allow them 1.5 million? Seems to me,
right.
Let me maybe frame this a little bit better. Seems to me we are holding the cruise ships to a standard higher than we are holding ourselves on shore. And I get that it might be because we're stressing the local septic or sewer systems with passengers. I just wonder how many toilet flushes, if you want, for a measurement there is when a passenger cruise ship shows up, or I don't know, maybe we need to tell them all to do their business before they leave the ship or something. I don't know what the answer is. I know that I've spent many, many weeks flying in the bush in Nome and other places that have really challenged sewer systems, even with the people that live there, not including tourists and that kind of stuff. And they have taken some, you know, the sign on the, you know, if it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down kind of thing. I mean, they, as a community, all take those kinds of steps to relieve the load on their sewer systems. And I don't know that we can blame all of this on the crews. I'd need to see more data to blame the pressure on the sewer systems in Sitka, Skagway, Ketchikan, to blame it all on the tourists on the cruise ships. I would need to see a lot more data than just this slide, I think. There's just too many variables.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, your observation is spot on. We are holding the large cruise ship vessels discharged to a much higher standard than we are demanding of our own communities. What you have in this particular slide with these numbers on here, as you note, the average monthly, average weekly, average maximum, those are allowances in the permit. So those are the maximums. That's what they're allowed to average over the course of these timeframes. Do they get there? They're close. And that's why I said they're bumping up against those. Do they exceed them? On occasion. Are they under? Oftentimes they're under, which is great. They're already treating. But we're holding the industry to a higher standard than we're holding ourselves to. Also, advanced wastewater treatment on a big, large vessel is significantly somewhat cost prohibitive for rate-paying customers in a smaller community. That said, this is also where we start to look at this other piece, which is creating that grant program. We want to improve. We recognize the need to improve our community wastewater treatment facilities and infrastructure, and we're doing our best to create a grant program that will provide them somewhere around $4 million a year. As a grant opportunity to make improvements to be able to help their treatment systems in the face of these CPV passengers. It is not just the CPV passengers and discharges. And I go back to what we talked about in terms of what that water quality sampling was. In the absence of cruise vessels in 2020 and 2021, there were exceedances in many of our ports that showed we have existing problems of fecal, human-based fecal discharges that are unrelated to commercial passenger vessels.
Thank you.
Before, Mr. Bates, yep. Perhaps you could, so I believe in refresh, 301H waivers, which are waivers of the Clean Water Act, regardless of the cruise ship industry, that we have 8 communities in Alaska that currently have 301H waivers, meaning that their local discharge systems do not comply with the Clean Water Act discharge standards, that when we say to industry, you must, right? Am I accurate? We talked about,
Madam,
I think it was back in January. So,
Madam Chair, that's an impressive knowledge you have on this. So the answer is 9 communities are operating under 301H waivers. These are EPA-based waivers from the requirement to treat to secondary level. So these communities, which include Skagway, Sitka, Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg, a whole bunch of communities. One of them in Anchorage, AWU, and one of them in Whittier, Pelican, and the other 7 are down here in Southeast. They only treat to a primary level of treatment. They do not disinfect necessarily. They're not required to, and they certainly don't treat to a secondary level. Juneau, some of these other communities, they're all currently under an APTES permit, a state permit, as opposed to an EPA-based permit. And they are treating it at a secondary level. Anybody that's on a 301H waiver, they're going through renewal this year. That's our discussion as EPA is reissuing and renewing or looking to renew those permits. And it looks like those communities are going to have to increase their treatment facilities to include disinfection to get to a better level of treatment on particularly fecal coliform.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one more follow-up, and I appreciate it. It looks to me, and maybe you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't want to blame our local communities' issues with their sewer systems strictly on the cruise ships. I think that would be a mistake, frankly. We're holding the cruise ships to a higher standard. Yes, there's an influx of passengers, but I think what I just heard you say is that those communities have problems regardless of whether – there are passenger ships coming or not. And it seems to me like we might be conflating two different issues into this one presentation. Skagway, Sitka, on some of our Wrangell, Petersburg, you know, some of those that have problems that are on those 301H waivers. And I agree with you, Co-Chair Hannah's memory is awesome because I didn't even remember that. But I don't think we can blame it on the cruise ships. Maybe that's a separate deal. Maybe we need to separate that out and say, hey, this is a problem, and we need to fix this problem, and then a certain amount of this might not be a non-issue in the cruise ship industry. Just an observation, maybe more than – maybe you could confirm what I just said.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, confirmed. We're fully engaged with the communities that are going through that. We're not interested in laying blame. As DEC, we're not interested in laying blame on either the cruise ship or the communities. We recognize there's a problem out there. We want to assist the communities in improving their treatment so that their waters and their environment are cleaner and healthier than they currently are. We're trying to find the path forward on doing that. We believe that this bill is one of those paths forward from restructuring some of that funding that comes in and providing an opportunity for the communities. But it's, you know, our directive is protect the human health and the environment. And it's not, we're not laying blame. We recognize there's a problem. So
perfect.
Representative confirmed.
Representative McCarty, long ago and far away before I started rattling on, you were seeking the floor.
So, thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. So I concur with what was just stated there, and I know that the cruise ship industry, we, the state of Alaska, greatly appreciate, Southeast greatly appreciates the cruise ships, and I know talking to different villages, mayors and such, seeing that we get money that could go to improving our systems. So after the cruise ship's over, we have even better systems because of the people coming to tour our communities. So that's nice. The $1.5 million, that's the standard that's expected. So not to say we want to breach that. However, if it's $1.5 million plus one, doesn't mean that we are greatly contaminated or there's our buffer saying, you know, when it reaches this area, it's going to be, I'm sure you have peace there. So for just the public to understand this, you know, what's that, you know, 1.5 million. And then the next fecal matter is, oh my gosh, we got to call on, you know, or really it's 15 million is the saturation or what is it?
Representative McCarty through the chair. This is awesome science. you said it a different term earlier, but we're getting into the how we permit projects, which is great. I will say the water quality standard that we apply for fecal, for example, at the level of 40 units, that is what seafood and mollusks and other things that might be in that water, they're still safe to eat at that level. They're not safe to eat at 1.5 million. If that clam that you picked on the beach is in that water at 1.5 million units, I wouldn't eat it. I would eat it if it was at 40 units. That's the big difference. So when we talk about the large vessels, for example, large vessels have that treatment facility, the advanced wastewater treatment on board. The water that comes out at the pipe, and this is on the hull of the boat, it comes out at that pipe, compliant with water quality standards at 40 units. The treatment facilities on shore, particularly the 301H waivered facilities that we're talking about that are discharging it, for example, 1.5 million. They cannot meet water quality standards and have never met water quality standards at the end of the pipe where they discharge. And so if you have the facility on shore and it discharges 40-foot pipe out into the water, what's coming out of that tube right there does not comply with water quality standards. The way we get around that is we apply a mixing zone. And so it's, you know, if you take underwater and invert it and you look at your chimney, the smoke coming out of that stack, it takes a little bit of time in the air to dissipate to the point where, okay, you don't smell the smoke as much as if you stuck your nose on the end of the pipe. That's what a mixing zone is. How much water do we need to be able to allow that fecal matter to disperse so it meets water quality standards at the edge of that boundary. That's what the mixing zone is. At the edge of that boundary, to go over that step, you're meeting water quality standards. So we provide communities like Sitka and Skagway and Ketchikan with the ability to discharge. EPA and 301H waivers issues the permit to discharge at that level with a mixing zone that says you will meet water quality standards at the edge of that mixing zone. Does that bring some science and answer your question?
We need thank you. You know, that brings the simple science of what's that saying? The solution to pollution is dilution. And that's what you're saying is the dilution of and the tides moving, and that moves the fecal matter around. And I the intent of this meeting is to discuss the cruise ships and that piece there, and don't want to get it muddied with this other piece, but I'm looking forward to further discussions regarding that for our communities and for the mariculture that we're looking at. It's like, okay, this is greatly concerning if we're trying to encourage agriculture in the waters, and yet those waters may not be so good. It's not because of the cruise ships, it's because of our own, you know, communities.
Yes.
Anyways.
Well, so you know, Representative McCarty, no one in one of these coastal communities, no one here in Juneau digs clams in Gastineau Channel. People aren't, you might set crab pots at the far end of Gastineau Channel, but, you know, sort of the, you don't swim in a harbor, you don't pick clams where you can see the houses that have outflow lines. People in coastal communities know it, whether you got a 301H waiver or not. And those mariculture permit applications, none of them are right inside of community discharge mixing zone areas. They all get that. And ADF&G and DNC, if for some reason, I assume that if they had a mariculture permit that was going to put you in there, they're going to encourage you to move further away from the community, because we have, besides wastewater treatments, we still, all across coastal Alaska, we have lots of houses and lodges that have direct outflow lines that were permitted when they were built. And as we've grown, now there are people close by, and maybe your discharge line still is just a direct discharge line. At low tide, it's got to be underwater, but that's really not very far removed. Representative Shragi, you have been seeking the floor.
Well, thank you, Coach Johannan. Actually, many of my questions were answered in that last little exchange. Appreciated that, just trying to understand how some of these standards or maximums are determined. And I think there is, you know, two different standards, but I think one is, part of the reason for that is a recognition that the cruise ships do go into very sensitive environments sometimes, and there may not be the amount of water and mixing and dilution that you might want to see in those sensitive areas. And I think this is difficult because we're talking about cruise ship monitoring, but we've kind of intertied that with the onshore communities through this funding mechanism, and I think there's certainly a lot of room for improvement on the onshore communities. And I imagine that if we were to go into these communities and use these funds to do system upgrades, we could spend a lot of money doing upgrades. And so, you know, as I think about all of this, one of the questions that I have that I'm not sure has been answered for me yet is, you know, to what – I know that when we talked about the things that remain the same, it's the ability to go in and do inspections, and we have that authority – but to what extent is that going to be funded and maintained and those activities pursued? Are we going to spend a lot of funding on onshore facility upgrades, which I think are a valid use of those funds and would be a good use of those funds, but are we going to still have funds left over for doing the inspections, which, to Coach Johannan's point, I think are very important. If you have someone at the stop sign, people are much less likely at a notorious intersection to run that stop sign when they see the cop sitting right there. And we have a long history of ship operators bypassing the monitoring systems or finding ways to get around the rules, whether it's a result of their systems just broken and they want to keep the crews running, or it's costly to do the upgrades, or whatever it may be, we know that people have skirted the rules. And so how do we find that balance? Again, recognizing that there's a very valid reason to spend these funds and divert these funds towards upgrading onshore facilities, but still ensuring that these cruise ships, which do go into sensitive environments and which do have a history of not always respecting our environment, how do we ensure that they're properly being monitored and we're doing our job as a state to meet the voter intention? And I think just good practices as managers and stewards of our state to make sure that our environment and our communities are protected. So all this is to say a lot to think about here. I've really enjoyed this conversation today. It's fascinating. Some awesome memories and insights. So looking forward to continuing to learn more about this. Thank you. Not much of a question there.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We need to remember that the cruise ships can move.
Yes.
And if a cruise ship with, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 human beings on it, that's 4 times the size of the community of Skagway. They can go anywhere, and who knows what they're releasing. So that's like multiplying Skagway and sending it out into a clean zone. There are times when there are 25,000 people in Juneau on cruise ships, and that includes the crew. I count the crew because they produce effluent just like the paying passengers do. And I do agree that we need to be looking at what our shoreside facilities are doing and their stressors when the ships are in. But they also don't have the ability to move. So they have to be dealt with in a different way. And I know this is coming up for Anchorage as well, and it's simply kind of terrifying what that could cost Anchorage if we lose that waiver. So it remains to be seen.
Representative McCabe.
I think you're winding up, and so I will too, but I think we need to also remember that, you know, this is a world economy, and we eat lots of fish from other countries that may not have the water quality standards mm-hmm. that we have. In fact, I've eaten fish tilapia where they say, well, don't eat the fish if it's caught downstream of this city on this river, but you can eat it if it's upstream. And I'm like, don't they swim through? I mean, fish don't stop at a certain boundary. So I suspect that as Americans, we are a little bit over the top on the cleanliness of what we're doing, which is great. Don't get me wrong. But the science to me is very interesting on how much, like I said, you might not have heard me, but maybe we just need more clams around some of these communities to, you know, dilute the pollution, right? Because it is a natural substance. We can't forget that. I think Americans are pretty protected compared to some of the rest of the world who uses human waste as a fertilizer on some of the vegetables that we probably eat if they're imported from another country. So just a minor point. But.
I know that we've got 2 slides to conclude, but, and again, we're mixing both cruise industry and local water standards. My recollection is previously that CPVE fees were not allowed, and we've had litigation about from the industry about what communities who collected those fees were allowed to use it for, and that they had not been allowed to be used for any community shoreside wastewater treatment improvements. The legislation is changing that. And is that correct?
Madam Chair.
For the grant program? That's
Co-Chair Shragi, Representative Drummond, Representative McCabe, thanks for all the comments. We are very close. I'm not winding up. I'm winding down, if you will. these are all excellent points. And last substantive slide here is the shoreside facility upgrades. And so let's talk about how much very quickly, and I'm less than 5 minutes away, if you will. And I'm sure the deputy wants to get some words in too. If we take 1.6 million passengers, we multiply it times $5 per berth fee, that's somewhere just a little bit above $8 million on an annual basis that comes in on those fees. Our staff, it's going to take a little bit of money to run the management oversight of CPVs through DEC, and that includes our AIR program is going to need a little bit of oversight for air discharge. Our spill prevention and response, they do all the oil spill contingency planning for all the vessels that come up here. Our staff, for both the monitoring programs that we have and for the oversight, it takes about $4 million for DEC to run the oversight program. So we're committed to that. That's part of our budget. That's what we do. That leaves about $4 million to provide to in a grant program for our coastal communities, our port communities. So we've got, in a normal year where it's a passenger load and there's paying fees, we have enough to run the state's oversight program and provide a cost-effective matter grant program for our port community. So it's the best of both worlds at this point. To get to your question specifically, Madam Chair, Section 13 of the bill does provide this grant program. We recognize what that tonnage clause piece is, and there's particular language in here that talks about what that is, and it's I think it's subsection D on page 6. Awards granted by the department from the separate CPVEC account shall be limited to the percentage of operations that the wastewater treatment collection facility expends servicing commercial passenger vessels. So we're creating that link back to our shoreside facility upgrades are linked back to the CPVEC system and passengers, which is that key provision in the tonnage clause case. So we've run this through law. Deputy Commissioner, you want any more on that?
I'll expand a little bit. We did have that same concern about the tonnage clause limitations and how we can use those funds that we collect from the commercial passenger vessels. And we did run the question through law. We need to be providing a service to the vessel. The rationale is that, I think as Representative McCabe alluded to earlier, that but for those onshore facilities that the passengers are using, they'd have to take care of business before disembarking from the vessels, and that would create additional load for the vessels themselves. So we threaded the needle there in terms of the exact language that we're using in the bill and how those funds can be distributed. We recognize that those onshore facilities are getting additional volume from passengers and crew that are coming through the communities. And so while their treatment technologies are not as robust as what the larger vessels have on board, and so they can't reach that same standard, that there's additional volume coming through, and that additional volume has an impact on water quality in the area around the communities. And so with that nexus, we think it's an appropriate use of the funds for the port communities.
And I agree and think it's appropriate. You agree and think it's appropriate. Our Department of Law, but I am concerned because some of the litigation we've had in these communities about the use of those fees in building restrooms shoreside has been predicated about federal cases in other states. And so, you know, it's a lift to change our statute. But I want to know where we are with both industry saying we're going to be good with it, or we're going to see a challenge, and where other states, because again, we're not the first place that has these same issues. You know, I think of Key West in Florida, a very small community that has that same intense use and onboarding, and you know, they've had struggles to put in local limits and constraints and then been told you can't and it's not tied. And, you know, I don't want to get into their own state politics over it, but we know that I'm looking for some of that information that I hope our Department of Law has looked at with federal court precedents about what we can do when we are using the tonnage clause and interstate commerce. We're trying to institute a law that benefits our communities and industry coming into Alaska, but we know that we don't get to regulate it solely, that, you know, whether those are coming out of Washington or whether they're registered in Florida, those ships, that industry has some say, and there's a lot of court precedent about it. So
as a committee, would be interested in seeing that to make sure that we're not crafting a law that's going to be challenged in court, where we're you know, it's going to save the industry some money, and our expectation is going to help its communities. But if we lose on that piece and all we've done is save the industry money, but we are not able to create a grant program that helps our communities, we still haven't solved our problem.
Okay. Yeah.
But that's homework that you may have already done.
Thank you, Chair Hannon. We understand that that issue is out there. We've had it examined previously, and we'd be happy to come back to the committee with the details of that analysis and how we looked at the tonnage clause issue, understanding that not just in other places around the U.S., but also the CLIA v. CBJ case recently and locally, that there are limitations in how we can use those funds. We believe that this proposal does thread that needle, and we have looked at it, but we can bring those details back as well.
Great. We'll let you close.
Just quick closing, Madam Chair, Co-Chair Shragi, members of the committee, thank you so much for taking the time at the top of the morning with us to not only allow us to present on this important bill from our perspective, but to ask your questions and share your information as well. We believe that this bill will provide an opportunity for us as a department to do a better management and oversight job of the industry. We believe that this provides an opportunity to improve wastewater treatment in Alaska, and we think it's the most cost-effective mechanism to provide a true service to protect human health and the environment. So again, thank you for the opportunity this morning. Happy to come back as necessary, and again, appreciate the questions and the opportunity to share.
Thanks.
Thank you both for being here and letting us grill you incessantly.
Yeah, great job.
We do have one more item to take up this morning. We're going to take up House Bill 402, an act relating to identification requirements for contractors and home inspectors. The committee has previously heard testimony on the bill, and we received no amendments. Is there further discussion of the bill? Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Madam Co-Chair. I like this bill. I've looked at it. I think we discussed it at great length the other day. I think we're all pretty much in agreement. I don't want to speak for the rest of the committee, but as for me, I think this is a good bill, and I think we should consider, if you're looking for the will of me, I think we should consider moving it out today.
And I want to just, we do have the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing, Glenn Hoskinson, on line to ask her questions. We did, I believe the division previously stated they had no concerns with this updating of statute interfering with any monitoring or consumer safety notifications that our current statute requires. Representative McCarty.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Hannah, and I concur with moving this. Also, the fact that this is not imposing on contractors to go out there and make websites if they don't have one. So we're not asking them to be IT tech specialists. They're specialists in their trade, but if they have one, just do it. So we're making it easy.
With that, any other members taking the floor? Representative Shragi?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 402, Work Order 32-LS1641-A from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, please just remain in the committee room after we adjourn to sign the paperwork. And our next scheduled meeting of House Community and Regional Affairs is scheduled for this Thursday, April 28th at 8 a.m. Let's hope that Wednesday we're not on the floor till 8 p.m., 6 p.m., or seeing no further business to come before us, we will be adjourned at 9:53 a.m.